Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man, I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you very much, Audrey. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're ready for another, well, I'm not sure it's a riveting, we'll call it riveting, edition of the Jumble Justice Radio Show, where we try to unjumble some things that are going on in the criminal justice field. I think you'll like our speakers tonight, our major speaker. He's a director of oral history at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library in Springfield, Illinois. And he has an interesting book entitled Patrolling Baghdad, the Military Police Company and the War in Iraq. And I like to think I know a lot about policing. I've got a lot of writing about it, served in it, directed it in a state, you know, that sort of thing. But I don't know much about military policing, actually. I was in the Marine Corps back in the Ice Age, and we had MPs then that worked at bases and that type of thing. But it's a special kind of thing, and especially these men and women that have been over in Iraq and Afghanistan time and time again, and we've got them doing door-to-door, house-to-house kind of things, and I don't know, don't get me started on that, because I don't think we should be doing that, but it's another thing. So I think you'll enjoy this, and he presents this at a bookstore, a Barnes & Noble bookstore, and remember those? Yes, but I think you'll enjoy this. We'll take a look at it tonight, and we want to thank Audrey, who's here tonight, Mike Sorrento, and of course Lucy Spears, who did a lot of the preparation for us for the radio show. What we try to do is look at events and issues and discuss them that relate to this field of criminal justice and its practice, and kind of a difficult field. I don't know if it's getting any better or not. Somebody told me they're having trouble getting applicants now in some places. We were in a point where, with all the criminal justice degree programs all over the country, people were wanting that. But don't take that as gospel. I'll have to check that out. But we dedicate our show to those corrections of police and court professionals that we're going to do. We have something going on in the community where I live that's been done hundreds of times, at least, if not thousands of times across the country. They're going to be combining city and county correctional facilities and jail and court and that type of thing. A lot of places have done that, and they say they're going to save money. And I always wonder, if your city's been around like 150 years and your county's been around 150, all of a sudden you figured out that maybe you could combine server to web. I don't know. We'll have to see how that goes. But it's been done successfully many, many, many places. So anyway, we try to take a look at what these professionals do. And Alan Levy is the CEO of BTR, Blog Talk Radio, and he's created this Blog Talk Radio network where you can have your own radio show within minutes. I mean within minutes. I'm not kidding. You can be signed up and broadcast every day, twice a week, once a month, whatever you want to do. I saw that when I logged on tonight. I don't pay much attention to it, actually. There's so much. Talk about overchoice. But I thought I saw that Oprah Winfrey has a show on Blog Talk Radio. I don't know why she'd want to do that with all the network possibilities she had. Didn't she own her own network, Audrey? I thought she had her own television network, but maybe she likes Blog Talk Radio. But anyway, you can get your show, and just amazing. It's still amazing. When he started a number of years back, you could sign up and broadcast worldwide at no cost, and unlimited number of listeners could listen to you. I mean, that is really something. These shows are archived also, so you can go to the website and for blogtalkradio.com, and you can look and listen to sites. And some of them do upload videos now, that kind of thing. I don't want to get into that. I like radio. I always say, I have the face for radio. That's not my line. It's someone else's. I forgot who it is, actually. But anyway, get your own show if you have time. Let's take a look tonight at some of the things that's going on. And you can call in if you want to. Nobody does. 347-996-5983 during or after the news section, 347-996-5983. But this is a long presentation tonight, as I usually have. And we won't have any time for that, actually. Let's do that. Well, let's listen. Let's take a look at a Bond joke. You remember we do those on the radio show? Here's a very interesting Bond joke. I really like this one. Let me crank it up here and see what it says. Here you go. A blonde, she began a job as an elementary school counselor, and she was eager to help one during recess. She was eager to help. So one day during recess, she noticed a boy standing by himself on the side of a playing field while the rest of the kids were out enjoying the soccer game. They were playing soccer. She approached him and asked if he was all right. The boy said he was. A little while later, however, she noticed the boy. He was still in the same spot, still by himself. She approached him again. She said, "Would you like me to be your friend?" The boy hesitated, then said, "Okay," looking at the woman rather suspiciously. Feeling she was making progress, she then asked, "Why are you standing here all alone? Why don't you go and join those boys playing soccer over there?" The little boy says, "Well, because," he says with great exasperation, "I'm the goalie for the soccer team." Oh, I like that one. I'd put that in my favorite box, Audrey, okay? I like the goalie for the soccer team. The Ohio Coalition, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, would like to have you listen to their public service announcement about reducing firearms deaths in the state of Ohio. By the way, I saw somebody making fun of Wayne LaPierre today. And Wayne LaPierre is, you know, in National Rifle Association, et cetera, written, published all kinds of things. He's autographed one of my books about guns, that type of thing. But they were making fun of him on the radio, and I won't get into who was doing it, but somebody should make fun of the person who's doing it because he's a lot funnier, a lot more to be made fun of. Here's the public service announcement, so listen carefully and please heed the warning and pay attention.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. I'm glad you did that. Now, here's a green tip. I thought this was something, and it made me – I picked this one out because it's not going to happen this week. why not take a stand by letting brands and manufacturers who consistently overpackage their goods know that that's the reason you stop supporting them. And there's nothing like purchasing power to force change. In other words, they're wasting cardboard, paper fiber, whatever it takes, plastics, all that kind of business. You've seen some things that are sort of overwrapped, but some of the things are rather cool, aren't they? Hey, like that word. I had Long John Silver's is doing their, I think, annual lobster bites. So when you get the lobster bites, they come in a red lobster little package, cardboard package, that guess what? It's a cutout. It's like a lobster. It's got, you know, little feet or whatever you call those things. But I thought it was very cool. It was very clever, packaging. But I don't think Esma Floyd, author of 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet, would actually enjoy that. But anyway, stop. You know, the next time you go to McDonald's and you want chicken McNuggets, if you're driving through, tell them you don't. You will not take them in the box. Just hold your hand out and get them in your hand and then drive away. Try that and see how it works, actually. I'll bet on a late night show some of them might be willing to do that. Okay. Book talk, we're going to save that to later. Oh, I did finish my book. I think I said that to you last week. Watch TV and Get Fit, too. So within a couple of months, that book is going to be on Amazon.com. It's going to be a bestseller. I'm actually going to try to market this book. I hope you see me on television. You can watch television and get physically fit, too. That's the name of the book. I think you'll enjoy it, and there's a little bit of humor in it, as you can imagine, kind of like my diet book. But here we go. All right, let's take a look at some of the news that's going on today. Oh, my gosh, there's absolutely crazy stuff in the news. I usually try to bring you things that aren't covered by everybody else on the air, but let's take a look at some of the things they're talking about here nationwide. Have you heard about the school bus driver in California? In fact, it shows this picture. His name is Brian Overcash. Overcash. I never heard of anyone with that name. It's a fine name. He's a Rowan County school bus driver. He remains in jail today after the Landis police say he allowed students to smoke marijuana on the bus. Apparently, this isn't the first time. But Overcash, age 30, was charged with four counts of misdemeanor contributing to the delinquency of a minor. The incident occurred on February 20th. Principal Matt Chrome contacted authorities about it. Chrome told officers with the Landis Police Department that Overcash, who drove the bus number 162, told the assistant principal that several students were on the bus smoking marijuana. So Chrome says all bus drivers are required to stop the bus and call 911. He didn't do that. And he said he didn't stop it because there wasn't anything he could really do about it. And he wouldn't be able to prove it anyway. They'd deny it. So anyway, he's being held in the Rowan County Jail under a $1,000 secure bond. He's probably out by now. But can you imagine a school bus driver letting kids toke on the bus? I mean, get real. My God. This one I love. Well, I actually don't love, but it's a very good warning. We've got some more research coming out. This comes from the University of Buffalo. Texting while walking accounts for more injuries per mile than distracted driving. This is according to a professor of emergency medicine who says he's treating a skyrocketing number of pedestrian injury cases. I've seen them bump into people, that type of thing. You probably have too, but pedestrian injuries are particularly dangerous because there's no protective area surrounding you when you're hit by a car, for example. This is Dietrich Jaley, professor of emergency medicine at the University of Buffalo. These pedestrian injuries are particularly dangerous in that they have higher mortality. We also view pedestrian injuries as a kind of high-risk injuries. Nationally, 41,000 pedestrians are treated yearly in emergency rooms. Up to 15% of accidents or more than 6,100 involve cell phones. Out of that 41,000, people talking or texting on their cell phone. So this is the first time there's been more pedestrian injuries related to cell phone use than there has been related to driving. Can you believe that? More than people being hit, you know, by jaywalking or not their own fault or people running a red light or whatever. So when texting, it says you're not in control with the complex actions of walking. Yeah, maybe walking is more complicated than we thought. He says, you're paying attention to the phone screen, of course. And he says, we see pelvic fractures, lower extremity injuries, and often the individual is thrown up on the car. And there may be head injuries as they hit the windshield. And you've seen, you don't have to go many places. Go to any big city, go downtown, you'll see people walking across the street, either talking on their cell phone or most of them are doing texting. You know, you got the whole line of 15,000 people that are tweeting you and want to say they like you, they don't like you, they like you a little bit, and you want to see how that makes you feel. Ohio State University study found that the number of pedestrian injuries involving cell phones tripled between 2004 and 2010. Isn't that incredible? Well, the total number of pedestrian injuries dropped. So pedestrian injuries with cell phones are way on the way up, and other pedestrian things are on the way down. And I don't think it's, I think it's against the law in a lot of places, a city ordinance to walk, might be a state law in some places, to walk across the street using your phone. But maybe texting is not considered using your phone or talking on your speakerphone or whatever. They say that attempts to legislate this, walking and texting, have been strongly voted down, probably by people who are texting while they're considering the legislation, right? Unbelievable. I thought this was interesting, also part of the tech world. If you joined us last week, I think you enjoyed that presentation, that show about cyber terrorism, some of the truisms and some of the myths about what we're doing. We're spending money on all kinds of things that are likely to never, never, ever happen. But anyway, this is a San Francisco South of the Market bar. It's frequented by a high-tech crowd, and there, a woman was in there wearing Google Glass. You know, the glasses, with the, it's actually a little computer. You can take pictures of people, trace her, it'll identify them. There's all kinds of apps for it now. It's not out yet, but probably here in about 3 months, Google Glass will be available to everyone. And people are getting mad about it. They don't want to sit down and have dinner or have a drink with their favorite friend or whatever, and people are taking pictures of them. They don't like it. And I kind of agree with that. You know, if you're out with your family and you're sitting somewhere in a booth and you pick, selected a private booth and you got goofballs in there taking, you know, movies and still photos of people all through the restaurant, I've seen people doing it. And I wonder, what the heck are they doing? Are they working for the CIA or what, you know? The CIA wouldn't do that. But anyway, this place is many of the Willows are applauding the move and the owners. They say they think it's a great idea. People want to feel comfortable when they go out, in particular when they go out and drink, says one bar patron. They don't want somebody taking a picture of them and then posting. You know, if you got, you know, if you're not so attractive or you got big ears or something like that, somebody takes a picture of you and posts it up on Facebook or something else on the internet, it's really kind of stupid. But I think you're going to see more controversy about that as and it's not going to take very long because people are really getting sick of it. Speaking of taking pictures, the Massachusetts highest court has just ruled this week that a man accused of secretly snapping photos up a woman's skirt on an MBTA Transit Authority train did not break the law. The state Supreme Judicial Court on Wednesday dismissed charges against Michael Robinson. Apparently this guy gets on the train, or the transit train, and takes pictures of women, you know, tries to take pictures up their dress, up their skirt. And they're looking at the law, so the defendant must willfully photograph the subject was another person who was nude or partially nude, and they're saying that these women aren't partially nude. And prosecutors argue that a right to privacy beneath his or her own clothes ought to exist, but justice has ruled that the alleged incident occurred on a public trolley, and there's not a reasonable expectation of privacy on a trolley. And they could say the same thing about that taking pictures in a bar or restaurant or, you know, a school or wherever you are, public library, that same thing. So we're going to see some law about this. I thought this was kind of an interesting one. I'm going to skip the one about the third grader smoking pot. You heard about that one, right? In the restroom, a girl walks in. I think she's like sixth grade or something like that. She walks in to see these kids, three of them smoking pot. They actually had a pipe for smoking at hell in the world. Anyway, police have arrested this guy in Tampa after his neighbors reported he was having sex with a dog. I'm not kidding. When they arrived on the scene, they were greeted by the small crowd, who was disturbed by this guy's activity, I can imagine. During the search, officers found a gun with ammunition belonging to this guy named Marcinek, who's a convicted felon. He's not allowed to have a gun. Animal service investigators took custody of eight large pit bulls that were found on the property. So, oh my, I don't even, reminds me of days of police work back in the Ice Age when you run into some strange people who try to have affairs in a very strange way with everything imaginable. But he's facing charges of cruelty to animals and having sex with animals and the illegal gun. Here's one I just don't get. Some churches in Summit County, Ohio, that's Akron area, they staged the arrests of protest pastors. The staged arrest, I'll read you the article actually, the staged arrest of pastors in front of their congregations in Northeast Ohio got a surprising reaction for one sheriff. Videos of the mock arrests posted online brought a wave of criticism for the Summit County Sheriff's Office from people who thought that deputies really were interrupting church services and making arrests. But Sheriff Steve Berry, he says his deputies took part in mock arrests Sunday at a couple of churches around Akron after the pastors approached his office and asked him to participate. What? The churches staged the arrest as part of their defending the faith sermon. I mean, I can understand purpose there and all that business. But the video showed deputies handcuffing pastors while they preached and then placing them in patrol cars. The sheriff says he wishes that they would have put the videos online and noted that these were all staged. But I'm not sure why would a sheriff want to get involved in that. Would you want to do that? I don't think so. I think that's a little silly to want to do that. But I understand the motive. It's a nice motive and all that to help the church. But do we need to do that to fill the churches nowadays? I'm not sure. I doubt it. We'll see. Okay, that's it for the news tonight. Now we're going to switch over and listen to this presentation by Mark DePew. And he's the author of the book Patrolling Baghdad, A Military Police Company in the War in Iraq. And this is interesting stuff. Some of you listening, I know a few, have actually been there, and some have been to Afghanistan, Iraq. But this is, you know, what do military police do in an assignment like that? Have we expanded our duties to the point where it's beyond what's sensible? Or, you know, we'll listen to Mark and see what he has to say about that. So give me a second to get this all set up here. And, you know, we're using C-SPAN, so it's a little bit slow sometimes in the evening.
Invasion of Iraq. This talk from Barnes & Noble Booksellers in Springfield, Illinois, is 50 minutes.
Thank you, Valerie. Thank you, Sarah, and for all of those here at Barnes & Noble who've worked hard to put this together. It's a new experience for all of us, so I hope it goes well. As Valerie said, I've written a book about the 233rd Military Police Company. It's a unit memoir. It's their story of a year in Baghdad that they spent. And what I wanted to do is just talk a little bit about, first of all, how I chose to write the book in the first place. It was back in October of 2004, and I certainly knew that you folks were over in Baghdad at the time, but I suppose like most people in Springfield, I wasn't paying too much attention to it until I saw a series of articles in the newspaper. They made the front page of the Springfield Journal Register 8 days in a row. And I was reading these articles, and I was asking I should back up and say that at the same time I was writing my dissertation, my PhD dissertation, and the subject was the evolution of the citizen soldier in American history. So I'm reading the front page of the paper, great articles written by Marcus Stern, a Copley News Service reporter from Washington, D.C., with some wonderful photos that were taken by Nell Cepeda. And I'm asking myself how it is that a National Guard company from the middle of America ends up being stuck in Baghdad and given arguably the most challenging and the most important mission going on in Iraq at that time. And that obviously is to secure Baghdad, to the police and patrol the city to train the new Baghdad police force. How is it that they let a National Guard company do that? So I thought at that time, in October 2003, there's probably a great story here. And I kind of put it on the back burner because I was working on my dissertation and I had more pressing concerns at the time. Well, as it turned out, I was done with the dissertation about April, early May of 2004, and the 233rd was just arriving back in Springfield at the same time. So another happenstance, if you will. I get done with the dissertation. I ask myself, what am I going to do now? It's going to take a while to find a job in history. There's a glut on the market in that respect. And here's the 233rd back, and I still thought this was a great story, something that needed to be told. So I decided at that time that I'd seek out the company and see if they'd be willing to have their story told. I thought that with my dissertation, I mean, really, this story deserved to be the last chapter of my dissertation, although it wasn't. So I thought I was the right guy to tell this story. It happened to be the right time, since they were just coming back, and I was in the right place to do it. So a couple months later, I met with Captain Royer and First Sergeant Elmore, asked them if they were okay with doing this. They graciously consented, and they told me, we'll let you do this, but only if it's a story about the soldiers in the unit and not about us. And I thought that was a very telling comment that they had. I started interviewing the soldiers in August of 2004, and from the very beginning of actually sitting down and listening to their stories, it confirmed everything that I had felt in my gut before that time. This was a great story, a very compelling story. All of the essential threads of our problems and struggles in Iraq were in their stories, their personal stories. And so that's what I spent the next year and a half doing, listening to their stories and trying to put it down on paper. I can tell you this. When I wrote the book, I used their voices as much as possible. And this is their perspective. This is their side of the story. And that's part of what I wanted to accomplish, because I thought that perhaps the way the war is being discussed in the American media and in the public, that's the side of the story that's oftentimes neglected. Here's a picture of the unit while they're in Baghdad, taken by one of the unit members themselves. What I'm going to do here is just talk a little bit about the organization and just a little bit of background information, and then I want to spend the rest of the briefing, the rest of the presentation, touching on the themes that really drive this whole story forward, if you will. This particular unit, the 233rd Military Police Company, was there in Baghdad, as I mentioned, right from the very, very beginning. They opened police stations. They patrolled the city. They trained the nascent Iraqi police force, the Baghdad police force, and they were involved in some of the most traumatic experiences of that first year, especially things like the UN bombing. And again, they're citizen soldiers. This isn't their full-time occupation. They gave a human face to what's going on in Iraq. And as I mentioned before, this is their story from their perspective. Well, one of these people you should recognize, the person on the right, is First Sergeant Elmore. And First Sergeant Elmore is he was at the time a corrections officer, hails from the city of Winchester, and like so many others in the unit, from the small towns that surround Springfield itself. The person on the left is Captain Jeff Royer, who is a Springfield police officer. He is the canine officer for the city. And the fact that the two people we have up here tells us one thing about this unit. They have a lot of experience being police officers and corrections officers. There were 29 in the unit who had some kind of experience as police or corrections officers, sheriff's departments, not just from Springfield. There was 10 from the Springfield Police Force. There was another firefighter. I don't know what to tell you. Okay. I understand there's a technical difficulty. And since we got a technical difficulty, maybe somebody can try to figure out why the slides aren't advancing like they're supposed to. I don't know what you're looking at here.
I think they're trying to fix it. Hold on.
The 33rd Army National Guard Police.
These are citizen soldiers, not regulars. And quite frankly, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book and to tell this story is because oftentimes what we see and hear in the media is always focused on the regulars. The Marines get a good share of the attention. The regular Army, the 4th, the 1st Infantry Division, units like that get an awful lot of the attention. You don't hear as much about the National Guard or the Reserves. And this was a war where the National Guard Reserves were playing a big role. You think back to Vietnam, only a handful, probably in less than 5 National Guard Reserve units ever got to deploy to Vietnam. By design, President Johnson determined this would be a war that was fought by the regulars. But we are not in that era of the military anymore. It's a volunteer force, and the Army can't go anywhere and fight a substantial war unless it's got tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of National Guardsmen and reservists. And what that means in one sense is that every single community in the country is impacted by this. So I suspect all of you, or most of you, know somebody who's been there, who is going there, or is in the National Guard, is affected one way or another by this. That's the implication of being a citizen soldier in that respect. So they're citizen soldiers. I think just as important in terms of what I'm trying to accomplish with this book is that the MPs are support troops. They're not combat troops. Now, for combat, I mean the infantry and the armor and the cavalry units and the artillery. Those who we normally think about when we're thinking about the military, the folks who do the actual get down and dirty fighting of it. The military police are what we consider the combat support troops. You put them together with people like the civil affairs units, medical units, transportation units, engineer units. Those are the kinds of units that you really need to have to fight a counterinsurgency war. So part of the reason why this is such a compelling story is this is exactly the kind of unit that is best at fighting counterinsurgency. It took the Army a while to figure out that's what we had in Iraq. That's what we have in Iraq. And the MPs are ideally trained and suited to do that mission. Because of that, there's a part in the book, and I ran into a gentleman earlier tonight. We're training a lot of other people, cross-training them from their original duties to be military police officers once they get there, because there's just a dire shortage. So that's important to understand as well. Humanitarian effort. Just like the MPs of the 233rd took initiative in a lot of other respects, they took initiative in this arena as well. And what you saw were patrols driving through Baghdad. You drive by what looks like a dilapidated building and realize that was a school at one time or another. Weeds growing up, lots of trash, lots of broken desks, maybe a book or two here or there. Usually it had Saddam's picture in it. And almost all of the platoons decided one time or another they were going to adopt school and get them up and running. This particular picture that you see on top is from the Al-Saad School, which is one that the first platoon adopted. And a chapter of the book details what they did to get that school up and operational. From the first time of going in and cleaning up the school and having the teachers finally show up after they're there cleaning things up in the first place, through the time of arranging with the local Iraqi contractors to get the place cleaned up and get it operational again, to the time the school kids finally come back and the sense of accomplishment to see that, and then having a long campaign where they're talking to their relatives and their neighbors and their friends back home and convincing all of us back here in Springfield and other communities around the state and the country to send them school supplies, box after box after box of school supplies. So the bottom picture is the day that the soldiers of the 1st Platoon got to go back to Al-Saad School and pass out those school supplies to the women, to the young girls there. As it turned out, the girls went to the school in the morning, the boys went to the school in the afternoon. That was the nature of things. That's how the schools worked over there. The MPs decided, well, let's pass the school supplies out to the girls first. That probably would be a little bit easier. But they got to the boys later on. And in both cases, they were very well behaved and very appreciative of what they got. Not just schools, but orphanages as well. This is the Mother Teresa Orphanage, which is right across the river, just on the north side of the Tigris, but right across from the Green Zone. Mother Teresa Orphanage is exactly what it sounds like. This orphanage was started by Mother Teresa and her sisters after the first Gulf War. It dealt with the most destitute, the most handicapped of Iraqi kids. In most cases, these children had been dumped off at the doorstep of this orphanage. And the 233rd, and especially, I believe, the 32 Military Police Company from Wisconsin were the ones that adopted this orphanage and worked with it all the time. Now, I mention these two things because of the good work that was going on that the American soldiers were doing, that the 233rd was doing. But one of the things this really illustrates also, I think, is that here is the part of the story that quite often we weren't hearing back in the States. It was not the kind of thing that made the news. As a reporter who spent a week with the unit told me, and I'm sure most of you have heard this phrase, if it bleeds, it leads. Schools and orphanages and those kinds of things didn't make the news. So the soldiers would come back from leave and they'd say, I don't recognize the Baghdad that I know there. I come back here and I'm not seeing that story being told on TV. That was a universal comment I got from everybody in the unit. So, again, that's part of the reason I wanted to certainly weave these tales into the overall book. Another part that I definitely wanted to incorporate in the book was the importance of the family support group. When the unit first got over, for the first month, actually more than a month, they had a total lack of contact. You know, they left Kuwait, and they weren't able to tell their wives, their fiancés, their parents exactly where they were going and what they were doing. And so for a month, imagine yourself waiting back here, not knowing what's going on, except by turning on the television or reading the newspaper and see what's going on, because you have lost contact. There was plenty of mail that was going over, and I guarantee you the soldiers were writing plenty of letters back home, but there was a breakdown in the delivery, part because the military had made a decision to front-load all the combat, the military police units, those kind of organizations, and they cut themselves back on all the support groups to make those things happen. Once you get past that first month and a half and how difficult and trying that was, and wives having no idea not only where their husband was or what he was doing, but no idea when he would be coming back because they didn't know. After about a month and a half, you had just the reverse because it wasn't by July, I guess, you had internet access. So it was instantaneous after that point in time. Cell phone, internet, mail, everything worked great after that. But the family support group is very important. What that is an organization of family members who are left back in the States. And they get together and they figure out how to help each other cope with the separation, how to deal with those tough days, how to pass information around. In many cases, what you had the former unit first sergeant, Jerry Calbo, who was the person who mentored you in your job, I'm sure. Jerry Calbo stepped forward to be in charge of the family support group. And First Sergeant Elmore and First Sergeant Calbo back in the States made sure they were passing information back and forth. And a lot of the job back here was suppression of rumors, because rumors are going to happen. Rumors happen over there. And rumors among mice, especially, when they're coming back. What have you heard lately about when they're coming back? Well, I heard they're coming back by Christmas. Well, I heard they're not coming back for a long time after that. And you had to keep people informed as best as you could. So uncertainty was difficult in that respect. The family support group and the guard is especially important because unlike the regular forces, they all leave Fort Carson, Colorado, or Fort Belvoir, an active Army military post, where everybody in that little community is going through and experiencing the same thing. So if you're stuck in Monticello and you're the only wife in Monticello who has a husband overseas, it's difficult. It's hard. And nobody can relate to what you're experiencing. This is a family support group. And in the case of the 233rd, there was superb, and it proved to be kind of the blueprint for other units around the state as well. Now, I should mention the photo here. I love this photograph. This is their photograph of four women who got together, who met each other the first day they left, the first day the unit left. They met each other in a restaurant and decided they needed each other. They bonded with each other right from the beginning, and they ended up calling themselves the Band of Sisters. And they're friends to this day. Now, much of the book is carried forward by stories, the soldier stories woven together to make a larger mosaic of what was actually going on. In this case, there were two medics, the two medics that you see here in this picture, who were the first responders, first medical responders at the UN bombing that happened in August 27th, I believe. And so that particular story is a story about them dealing with the extremely traumatic injuries that they were encountering. Next one here, I don't know if it's the greatest picture because there were no actual photos, but there was an occasion where one of the patrols was driving around Baghdad, a joint Iraqi-American patrol. As they turned a corner, they looked down the street, and they saw a fire leaping out of the building. So they immediately went to the source of the fire. They organized the Iraqis around there to seal off the neighborhood, to start fighting the fire as best they could, hoping that there might be firefighting equipment that would be coming. And, of course, that was a long shot. And quickly, they noticed that there were several people on the roof. So there was four of them. They decided the only way those people were going to get down was for these four young men to barge into the fire, go up the stairwell, and rescue the people on the roof and bring them down. So for an occasion where you only had maybe 20 or so soldiers' medals that were awarded in the first year and a half of our experience in Iraq, four members of the 233rd were awarded the soldiers' medal for the highest award you can get for heroism in a non-combat operation. So just another kind of example of the kind of things that the soldiers were dealing with. This particular picture is the actual location of the main, the only major injury that the unit sustained. It's an injury by First Lieutenant Stephen Rice. In this particular case, what had happened was that there was another IED attack. A soldier, an MP from a different unit, had been injured. And the MPs were told to speed to the scene of the incident and establish security and render whatever help they could. So Lieutenant Rice's patrol stopped short of the actual ambush site. Several members dismounted. They started walking forward, and Lieutenant Rice got about halfway to the actual location of the other downed soldier when the second IED went off. His left side was pretty much torn up, especially his lower left leg. He was eventually taken to a medical facility in Baghdad in the Green Zone, spent one night there, was flown to Germany, spent several days there. Most of the time in Germany was spent in ICU because he ended up getting a serious infection. Then he was flown from Germany to Walter Reed, and he spent some time in Walter Reed, but he went back and forth between Walter Reed and Fort McCoy, Wisconsin, because he had a series of operations. Initially, they had fixed his foot at a right angle, and the doctors were telling him, this is about as good as we can do for you, and keep your foot, that it's going to be at a right angle for the rest of your life. The story follows him all the way through all of this recovery. It follows him through his experiences at Fort McCoy. And when he was at Walter Reed, he got superb care. When he got to Fort McCoy, the way the military works is you go through a medical review board, and you stay on active duty until this bureaucratic procedure figures out what they're going to do with you. He got to Fort McCoy. They gave him nothing to do except wait for the bureaucracy to do its thing. So being an MP, being an aggressive young lieutenant, he figured out something to do. He called whoever he could to try to get him someplace that was closer to home. He's from Alton. He's got no family. He's got no friends or anybody at Fort McCoy. So he works hard to figure out how he can fix that part of the Army's problem. And he eventually is successful to do that. The story also weaves in the occasion when he actually addresses the Illinois State Legislature, because he's one of the first people to come back from Iraq. He is the state's picture, a story that can present to the rest of the state, and he's honored by the legislature, and he does a marvelous job in giving a short speech there. Another story that's woven into the book, about 9 months after the unit got to Baghdad, driving around the city in unarmored Humvees, they had an opportunity to swap with another unit that had armored Humvees but didn't need them. So 9 months into this operation, they got armored Humvees. The first day of patrol after that point in time, this is what happened. Now, what you're seeing here is a little bit difficult to figure out. What you're seeing here is you're looking through the cab, through the driver's side, into the passenger side of the vehicle, and you can see that the windshield is bubbled out. This is the windshield right here. Tempered glass, reinforced glass, several inches thick. If it had not been for that windshield, that soldier behind there would have been dead. So one of the ironies, they were very lucky in that respect. Forging bonds. Again, this probably is a little bit different kind of a picture than you oftentimes seeing and hearing in the local press, in the national media especially. The MPs worked very hard with the local Iraqi police. They established a rapport with each other that was extremely strong, respect going both directions. Certainly the MPs had respect for their Iraqi counterparts, knowing the kind of challenges that they had in front of them. And I think you can tell by this picture the amount of respect and rapport that those Iraqi police had for the members of the 233rd as well. And along a similar vein is the camaraderie that the soldiers felt for themselves, between themselves. I don't know if I found any MP in the 233rd who didn't think, who didn't know that they were in the best military police company in Baghdad, in Iraq. That's what they thought. And I can also tell you, talking to their battalion commander, talking to other people in their chain of command, talking to two reporters who weren't necessarily the best friends with the military there, everybody had the same kind of comments to say, that this unit had uncommon leadership ability. The officers, the junior officers, and the NCOs are extremely tight-knit and cohesive group, and they were impressed by the cohesion, the discipline, and the camaraderie of the 233rd. That story came across loud and clear whenever I talked to the soldiers themselves. The last picture, and where I finished up the book, was the homecoming. I mentioned Vietnam before. Of course, the American public didn't necessarily greet returning veterans from Vietnam very well. And the members of the 233rd weren't really sure how they would be greeted either when they came back. What happened, flew into Fort McCoy, short ceremony there with Adjutant General, quite a few people there, dignitaries. But the real homecoming was in Springfield. They boarded a few buses, headed out of Fort McCoy early in the morning. By the time those buses crossed the border between Wisconsin and Illinois, they were picked up by a state patrol car. And the closer they got to Springfield, the more patrol cars and police cars started to get in line. So as they hit closest to Springfield and go under the overpasses, they start seeing people waving, holding up signs. And what you see here is what the convoy looked like once they got to Springfield itself. So you can see, I think it's three or four buses. Everything else in this line, all the police cars, the MPs were coming home, and these were their police, these were their soldiers. And you can see the camaraderie and the respect that the community had for them as well. And let me tell you, that was an emotional thing for the soldiers to experience. I don't think any of them will ever forget that experience of driving into Springfield. So that's the story of the 233rd. I hope you consider buying the book. I think it's worthy to read, not because I've written it, because this is an important and essential part of what's going on in our nation and our world right now. It deserves our better understanding sometimes. So at this time, I think we'll just open it up for questions and let it go from there.
Answer period. If you do have a question, if you would raise your hand and then I will call on you, and if you would stand and pause just a moment so that we can get the microphone on you, that would be great. Do we have any questions? Yes, sir.
Not necessarily a question, but I'm a veteran of the Korean War. When I came home, I had people ask, where was you? Were English? Somebody from New Berlin said, before I was shipped to Korea, will you be able to see your dad? My father is a prisoner of war in Siberia. That's the injustice of geography in the New Berlin school system.
Well, I'll answer your question, even though it wasn't a question, I guess. I've always been fascinated by the Korean War, and unfortunately, it truly is the forgotten war in American history, and it deserves a lot more attention, and the Korean War veterans deserve an awful lot of credit for doing it.
I might mention at this moment, you'll soon see a National Korean War Museum and a rumpus from the Abraham Lincoln Museum.
Okay.
Except we're still looking for people with deep pockets.
I'm looking forward to that.
Next question. Do we have any more questions?
Robert, would you want to say a couple words here or put you on the spot?
Absolutely. I've been put on the spot more than a time or two through this whole trip. Personally, and I think I can speak for the unit, Mark, I think it's a good representation of my unit. And I say my unit because I had the privilege of serving these soldiers. And I thank you for writing the book. In reading it, I thought, you know, it just kind of helped me relive it. And it's just an awesome thing to have. While we're sitting here and nobody's answering any questions or asking questions, I have a presentation.
Oh.
But Mark didn't know I was going to do this. When we were overseas, our battalion always was impressed with us. The 233rd, you know, in a book it mentions the kind of the, I shouldn't say animosity, but there's always a little friction between active duty and National Guard. And it didn't take us long to prove ourselves. Their battalion commander would call on us for missions before he'd call on some of the active duty ones. And we even had guys and commanders in the cab call for us instead of somebody else to support the unit. Our battalion, the Vipers, gave us a coin. Every soldier got this coin. It's got all the units, all the companies that served under the 519th. And, Mark, I'm going to present this to you for the way you represented the company, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. I've got a lot of coins. None that are this beautiful, and certainly none that mean this much to me. So thank you very much again. Okay.
Thank you. If there are no – oh, we have another question. Go ahead, sir.
Gentlemen, I'd like to know a little bit about the food and the diet that you and the supplies that you were able to obtain and how you got that, how you came by that.
Well, of course, when we first started, sir, it was MREs, meals ready to eat. They've improved quite a bit. You can actually get some fairly decent meals, although at 3,000 calories per serving and at about 60 grams of fat per serving, it's not always the most healthy thing, but it will get you by. After a while, the supply was slow going. You know, things didn't get to Baghdad real quick. We got our rations. They boiled them up, served them to us. Some of them were okay. Some of them were just food. Favorite meals, usually with coffee and Pop-Tarts. But my favorite anyway. Supplies, we struggled with supply system because it just wasn't catching up with us, particularly with our vehicles. Our vehicles are running all the time. And with the heat and everything, the tires were the first thing to go. Basically, it breaks all safety rules. If it held air, you went out on a mission. And if it popped, the supply section come out with a record and picked you up. And we just made do. And National Guard, you know, has so many skills when you get in the country. It's just amazing. We had, you know, electricians and air conditioner repairmen and mechanics other than our regular mechanics. For instance, when we first got in Baghdad, active duty was trying to figure out a way to clear everything off. A couple of my soldiers hot-wired an abandoned truck and soon started loading garbage and everything on this truck until it ran out of gas.
Well, we're going to have to cut it off there this evening. I hope you enjoyed that. I thought they would be more personal stories, and I'm sure these guys have lots of them, and probably the oral history section of the presidential Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library has some of these things. But anyway, that's it for this evening, and what we'll do is we'll see you next week, and we'll ask Vera Lynn to sign off for us, as she usually does, singing "We'll Meet Again."
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know. Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go,